Welcome, everyone, to episode 70 of Underserved. Today with me in studio is John Blythe, VP of Engineering at Combined Curiosity. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
John, thank you so much for joining us here on Underserved.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
All the way from Indianapolis. We really appreciate you coming out.
Love it. I'm so happy to be back in Boston.
Excellent. So when you were young, what was the initial spark that got you interested in tech?
A lot of it goes back to the seeds that Leo Laporte and Kevin Rose got me interested in, just some of the hackery type stuff that was going on that they would talk about. I had a few friends who were a little bit more computer nerdy than I was that I started to gravitate towards. And then the real kicker for me that got me into web and then eventually software proper was John Mayer's Heavier Things album website, done by a company called 140DB.
That's loud.
Yeah, exactly. And that album went on to be, I think, double or triple platinum, and that put them on the map. And I just fell in love with it. It was a Flash site. That's when Flash was having its heyday. And so I dove in and instantly got a contract and a check. And at that point, I'm 15 years old, maybe 16, cashed the check. The friend who was going to help me learn web development and do this guy decided to bail. And so, feet to the fire, $500 in my bank account. I had to make good on that promise. And so I did. I figured out Flash and made this dude a website, and the rest is history.
Wow. So Flash uses, is it ActionScript in order to do stuff?
Yeah. It's kind of a cousin of JavaScript. And I was a weird Flash guy because I gravitated towards the ActionScript and doing more programmatic motion and interactions and whatnot. So yeah, that's kind of where I cut my teeth.
So when you're done, what does the Flash thing do that the guy wanted it to do?
It was basically a guy's personal portfolio website. He did something in healthcare. It was a guy that my dad had worked with. My dad was an executive recruiter in the healthcare space. And I honestly can't remember much about this gentleman, except that he was very trusting of a kid to produce a website. And thankfully, I delivered. And I have no idea what the outcomes were for him. I hope it helped him, but it definitely helped me. So I'm thankful for the opportunity.
Yeah, I remember being a teenage contractor, getting my first gig and just being scared out of my mind about delivery. And if you make it happen, it's a huge confidence builder.
For sure.
So was that when you started Justix Development?
Yeah, it was with that same friend. We were in a band together, and you can kind of see the underlying theme here. I was a musician first, and Steven Roberts, who ended up being a brilliant engineer, really, really smart guy. The reason that he kind of bailed on that one project was his mom said, partnerships are a bad idea. It's just so funny looking backwards. But yeah, I formed Justix Development with him. And then by the time we got that first check, it fell apart and I just carried it forward and through the rest of high school and then into college, did contract work to pay the bills and learn.
Now, you mentioned one of the gigs was making these wedding invites that were like one of those little coaster CD thingies.
Yeah, that was fun. There was a guy named Craig that I met on forums. So, during the summer, during the weekends, I was just stuck on my computer, pirating music, probably drinking coffee when I shouldn't have been because, I was young and whatnot, and just learning and interacting with different people. And there was a really, really great designer named Craig that I met on one of the Flash forums, and he was asking some questions and I offered some help. And we became friends. He was in Ohio. I was down in Alabama. He's mid-20s. I'm 16, 17, maybe 18 at that point. And he was about to get married and had some great ideas and for his wedding invites to be digital first and send out those little coaster CDs. And I helped him with ActionScript do all of the interactive portions of it. He had all the design assets. And from there, we went on and did one or two clients as well. One of them was a recording artist, Brad Bird, BYRD. He was a lot like Pete Yorn. He may have even roomed with Pete during college or something. Never really took off, but was well known in that little section of the industry. And so did some cool work with Craig and was a great little dynamic duo, but obviously very different stages of life. And so we lost contact and just kind of went our own ways.
Now, you said you're a musician. What did you play?
Lots of things. Guitar is my primary instrument. Still play to this day and kind of gig around town in Indianapolis. I do one-man show. I provide Beatles to Bieber. So just like top hits from the last 50, 60 years, one-man show, acoustic and vocals. But back then, I was really into my electric guitar. On the one hand, shredding with prog rock. And on the other hand, Stevie Ray Vaughan, just thick, nasty Texas blues. So I was always on a guitar back then.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So do you try out CS while you're in college at all?
I did try out CS, and tryout is the the really important word there. I did one semester of CS, and I did not like the instructors. I did not like the curriculum. I was bored because I'm much more of a doer and learning kind of on the ground instead of in the classroom. Looking back, I think that there was also just a disconnect with my peer classmates. I wasn't a full-on Dungeons and Dragons type of CS major, and so there was just a lot of disconnect. We would see each other in class, but I didn't have a community to kind of go through that process with, so there was no staying power. There's no stickiness to it. When you mix that with the boredom and the frustration for getting anything real or actionable into the world, because I think that that's kind of a through line in my career and my personality, is that the reason I dove in was because I saw what the John Mayer site looked like. I wanted to make something. I'm not a Stack Overflow type of engineer who's answering a bunch of questions because I love the bits and bytes. I love product. And as a result, I figured out how to make products real and to instantiate some idea into the world to make an impact or to solve a problem. The way I phrase it, as I am now in more of a leadership role with people, is I will never be the smartest engineer on the team. And if I am, then God help us. I'm not a great programmer, but I'm a really damn good engineer because I'm all about solving the problem itself. So I very much like the high level, the cross collaboration, the mosaic of picking out different technologies and design patterns, whether it be at the architectural level or the legitimate UI and UX designs, to bring something into the world that solves the problems, makes an impact, helps people live better lives. So that's really where my niche or my strength is and what I've realized I need to lean into.
Now, you said two things that made me think of an old saying when you were talking about partnerships and about your experience in CS class and not really broing out with your peers, that if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with a team.
Yeah.
And it is easier to kind of break out and get a little something done yourself, but it is much easier and much more reassuring, especially when you hit the bumps, when you feel like you have a community of people that you're working with in order to drive things forward.
Certainly. As much as I love quick iterations on proof of concepts, one of the things I've realized is I've got this little mantra of people, playbooks, products, because I think that those are all emergent from the people first aspect. You know, you look at a band like Metallica. Everybody knows him, right? But Dave Mustaine from Megadeth, who was also peak metal rock in the 80s, was their guitarist initially, and he got booted, and they replaced him with Kirk Hammett, and it's totally different sounds because the people are the first part of the equation, and then that sound is the emergent quality of that cobbling together of people. And so if you start with a product and then try to put people around it, it's just the square peg in a round hole. You got to have the right people to go the distance. And once you have the people, you actually know which way that you can take this. That's become really, really important to me as people first when it comes to tech.
So what do you end up doing in college if not CS?
A few things. So I jumped from CS to music because I loved guitar. I thought, fine, I'll finally take a guitar lesson. I was self-taught. And I loved my guitar instructor, but I just had no real desire to come out with a guitar degree. And so after a semester of that, I pivoted to music business. It wasn't a super strong program, and I was beginning to feel that push and pull of my hobby, my love, is becoming just a grind. And I have to do schoolwork around it, and I didn't like that feeling. So I pivoted yet again and went into one of the most broad things possible, communication, with an emphasis on interpersonal rhetoric. So you can once more kind of see the personal and the people side of my orientation there.
Definitely. You mentioned something, the hobby as a grind. Like, mm-hmm. I've heard that so many times. Like, we have the competitive barbecue team, and mm-hmm. everyone's like, you should open a restaurant. I'm like, do you know how much work that is?
Yeah.
I work enough now. I would work way more and have less free time if I were to turn that hobby into a grind.
It is really tough. And that's going to be an incredibly good thing to loop back to a little bit later, I think, when we get further down the line with what I'm doing now. So let's make sure to pull on that thread.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So what does your first job end up being like in the industry?
Yeah, I joined a company called Televox, which had just a few months before I joined been acquired by West company, which is a Fortune 500. They did the texting to vote for American Idol. So pretty big deal, right? And Televox was a little homegrown company that did the automated voicemail calls from your orthodontist and your dentist to remind you that you have an appointment or you have an overdue bill or whatever the case is. And as part of that offering, they started doing billing. As part of that offering, they started doing kind of the digital front door, as we would call it nowadays, with, hey, buy this technology from us. We'll give you a website too. And so I joined the web development team at Televox as a 21-year-old, I think. That was my first real job, so to speak. I was in .NET Nuke, which is something I never want to have to work in again. And just a very, very non-hungry environment. There was no desire or appetite for innovation. There was no willingness to take chances whatsoever or progress for that matter. Very difficult for me to stay put. I did, thankfully, because it was so humdrum, it gave me plenty of time to do, you know, wandering out in the pastures alone and playing around and tinkering and spinning up new ideas. And they would end up never really getting traction because, again, there was no appetite for it. But it gave me a chance to play. And so I started doing little Facebook applications back when Facebook apps were all the rage. And it was even before and then during Facebook rolling out their Graph API. And so that was my first real pivot into software, maybe with a lowercase s, you know, software adjacent. And that began that pivot for me in terms of focusing on delivering tooling and things that users can engage with to do a certain task instead of just more of a marketing, visual, interactive sort of app that isn't truly an application in any dynamic sense. I was so hung up on the boringness that 2 weeks after my first child was born, I put in my 2-week notice and took a huge chance and went on to the next journey.
So what is that next journey?
It was a company called New Ink, New Ink Design. And so this idea of, you know, pixels are the new ink. The pen is mightier than the sword, and writing and ink changed the world and, you know, got us to that stage of human evolution or cultural evolution. And ink now as pixels is the next stage. And this is what you have to do, is table stakes for any business or ideas or industry. I met this guy on Twitter. His name is Nick Wangler. I gave him some advice about him spinning up some projects. And then a few months later, his developer had to go to officer training, something like that. And Nick needed help finishing a project. So I jumped in. We had great chemistry. So we just kept going. And then eventually, a few months later, I left my job at Televox. So the idea of New Ink that I partnered with Nick on was we wanted to be a little incubator and do MVPs or POCs for startups that were bootstrapping or just had pre-seed capital and help them realize their vision and go raise off of it. We did that. It wasn't nearly as successful or at the level, I should say, that we thought it would be. It was much lower level application development. It was still fun, still lots of learning. We were kids. We had no idea what we were doing. I was doing music on the side and some other gigs and contract work of my own and just trying to cobble together these very meager streams of income to have an aggregate, still meager income. And so, yeah, it was fun. I very much have oriented my career initially without knowing it, and now very pointedly on learn versus earn, and ideally both, of course, but learn versus earn kind of paradigm. And that was a huge learning period for me. And then our biggest contract was with two startup founders that wanted to shake up the healthcare supply chain industry, Andy Perry and Steve SirHeinrich. And we did a contract for them to do a POC, and that's all they wanted. It was a clickable dummy prototype for investors. And then they said, okay, great, thanks. We're gonna go raise off of this and then build the MVP. And we said, hey, let us do the MVP for you. And they said, no, it doesn't really seem like it's your strength. We're going to take proposals from other companies, but thanks again. And we pestered them and wouldn't take no for an answer. So they said, fine, throw your hat in the ring. Ends up, they chose us. And so then got to build the MVP for that. That became the alpha. And then they started asking if I would join. I said no, because I was committed to Nick. I was committed to New Ink and didn't want to abandon ship. Around that point, started to expect second child and realized, can't keep doing this cobbled stream of income. I need something that's a little bit more consistent and hopefully larger than what all the aggregate income has become. And I start to see more of the financials, start to see more of the opportunity. Really enjoyed my dynamic with Steve and Andy, and talked to my wife at the time and said, let's go for this. And she said, yeah. So we did. It moved us from Alabama to Indiana because we had to be somewhere in the state per tax benefits that in-state investors get if a certain amount of capital is left or invested within the state itself. And we wanted to move anyway. So that was a great chance to do so. And the rest is history. So then I joined Curvo. That would be January of 2014.
And what is Curvo doing? What do they successfully raise money for and start implementing with their alpha and their beta and their real imp?
Yeah. So healthcare is a complete mess, as we've seen the last couple decades now. Even when it's a high priority within the cultural conversation and there's legislation all around it, it's still terribly broken. It is still ironically sick. So a big part of that is that there are just really bad misaligned incentives that are compounded by lack of visibility by the people within the supply chain part of the organization. There's so much happening. It's so rapidly changing within the day-to-day operations. And a lot of times supply chain leaders work their way up the organization. They don't necessarily have an MBA. They're not a finance guru. They're not a data person. And all of these things just kind of come to bear while they're putting out eight other fires. They somehow have to figure out, are we being effective and efficient with our capital here? Is there something else that, especially within the physician preference item space, which is to say anything that goes in your body, you break your leg and you need a rod, you have a heart valve that you need put in, any of those sorts of things, physicians have options. It's not like a glove where a glove is a glove is a glove or bed sheets, right? It is that Zimmer Biomet makes part A and Synthes makes part B. And you have these medical device sales reps who are swearing that if you use their device, world peace will come about, hunger goes away, and you're going to be the best doctor in the world. And there is not a lot of visibility in terms of what are the actual patient outcomes. Why am I paying an extra $600 for this one screw that goes in five times in this surgery that I do five times a day across the course of a year? And you're looking at millions of dollars potentially because physician A wants to use a slightly different piece that has no known outcome differentiations.
Now, you said something interesting about this that I never knew. So these sales reps are actually scrubbed in the operating theater and are handing them that rod for the leg or the screw or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a pretty close relationship with the doctor. And it certainly sounds like the finance folks are out of the loop.
Yeah, it's all post hoc. And so there's multiple factors here. One is that the physician may be trained to use vendor A versus vendor B. It could be that they were wined and dined. And it doesn't have to be sinister by any means. You know, we don't have to ascribe malice or any sort of backhandedness to any of the players here. It's just that the incentives are simply misaligned and there's enough flexibility for them to stay misaligned. Now, sometime during the Obamacare era and while I was at Curvo, the Sunshine Act came out where any expenditures over X amount of dollars by a vendor for a physician or a hospital staff had to be logged and submitted. And there was a national database where that was there. So it helped to shine a light on it and hopefully sterilize some of it. But there's still so many ways to get around that. And if you're a physician and I'm a rep and I invite you to come speak at my conference, oh, well, it happens to be in Malibu and we're going to set you up. Like there's all these things that you could still argue are aligned with the business, which is fine and clean and it's not a bad thing. But there's so many upshots and knock-on effects in terms of loyalties and framing biases that come into play that the physicians a lot of times aren't even aware that the screw that they've been handed in this procedure room so many times doesn't actually do a lick better than the other one that's half the price. A lot of times getting to the physician and showing them the data in a way that's meaningful, they are surgeons because they're top performers and they want to be the best at what they do. And they would get pissed sometimes when they would see that they had intentionally or otherwise been played and didn't have the right information at hand. And then whenever we could get the physician on board with lowering costs and having better outcomes and being more efficient with the hospital's expenditures, man, it was a home run.
It reminds me a lot of like when you're making a movie, you'll hire someone to do the lighting, a gaffer. The gaffer comes with a 1-ton or 2-ton or 3-ton truck full of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask him to take that REM18 off the truck, bang, it's money.
Yep.
But you said here that even there could be a 6-pack of screws, and if they tear it open and use one, now you're paying for the 6.
Deal for the whole thing.
There's just all sorts of opportunities to run up the bill and, you know, not know it. So what did Curvo do about this?
So provided visibility was step number one, just getting the stream of data to where, because there were so many other things on the plate of a supply chain person, this was the thing that would always get buried beneath. As long as the procedure would happen and everybody turned out all right, I don't have the time in the day to go hunt down all these Excel sheets, pay a subscription to maybe ECRI, their price guide product, to look up what is the cost of this, and one by one, figure out the analysis. So Curvo would just get the stream of data each month and provide visibility. Here's the market trends. You're paying 50% over on this, or here's the 90th percentile for cost on this product. And we got everything. So their Bluebell ice cream from their cafeteria down to the screw that they put inside your leg whenever you had some terrible accident. What we focused though on was the physician preference items, because that's where so much of the juice was to be squeezed. They could use it for their Bluebell ice cream or anything else, but we provided all sorts of RFP workflows around the categorization of clinical procedures. So breast implants versus knee surgery versus heart valves versus rhinoplasty and all these different things, where all of the parts that would be used within that kind of procedure were automatically categorized and grouped and clustered together. So you could just go to your dashboard, click into rhinoplasty, see all the spend related to that, see what the correlation of this versus that, and just get a sense of, am I good enough or am I completely upside down in this? And if so, what do I want to do about it? And from there, you could, you know, click a button or two and send out requests for proposals directly in the app to medical device vendors that provided the same parts and see if they would give you a better offer, and then compare what you're spending now side by side with 2, 3, 4, 5 different offers and make a decision there. And then the contracting portion would go offline and we would bring that back into the system. So it truly was end to end.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first.
You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
Now, when I was reading about your experience there, I saw that you were also the director of GIFs and comedic timing.
Yeah. So I stayed on since leaving. And one of the things I've seen in my career is that I unintentionally become a huge part of the culture. And I think that my former employees have been interested in keeping me around for those kinds of purposes. And so wherever I go, I want to have fun. I want to make a positive impact in people's lives. And I want to have a good time doing it. If either of those aren't on the table, I'm not going to be around for very long. And so I love using GIFs, pictures worth 1,000 words, and a 5-second moving picture is worth however many more. So I really enjoy making sure that everybody's enjoying their time at work, because I think happy people produce happy customers at the end of the day.
Yeah, I've been known to be a memer amongst our coworkers and my family on occasion. You said a few things over the first part of your career that also happened to me and I think are a great idea for most folks. One, being at a company where you can be a little bit bored, where you can finish your real work in 10 or 20 hours a week and have some free time and use those idle hands to learn something new or experiment. I think that's great. Usually has to be a bigger company in order to afford someone that can be at that productivity level. But then also going to a startup and realizing there's no one else to do all this stuff.
Yeah, it was something I took for granted, because with Curvo, if we didn't produce, we didn't eat. And with New Ink before that, even more so, if we didn't produce, we didn't eat, we didn't have any capital raise or anything like that. I was doing these other jobs. It was truly just the grind led to the dinners that we would have with our families. And then with Curvo, it was better, but it was still very much, if we don't make this pivot, we're going to run off a cliff and we're going to have to go find normal jobs again and be bored again. And so that was something that was really interesting in my change to Kairos. Was it was a Series D later stage startup, and just seeing the difference in a larger organization in terms of execution. There's a lot more margin to take your time to bike shed on something or to theorize. That's one of the problems with startups, is that it could become like a bunch of peewee soccer kids chasing a ball. Nobody has a position that they're playing. Everybody's just chasing a ball. And it's a sign of maturity in an organization that people know their role. They've got their lane. And of course, you can jump over and be helpful. We want that. We want cross collaboration. We don't want silos. But everybody is responsible for something. instead of just, again, chasing the ball. And so at Kairos, I still had the small startup mentality. And I'm just running and gunning. And I was talking with the colleague that I'm staying with. I'm saying, I began to become self-conscious of people thinking that I was just doing power grabs and trying to get more landmass for my own career ladder or anything like that. And I've never really thought about career ladders. I've always just gone where my curiosities have led me. I've been very blessed to have a job sprout out of that. And I think people said it jokingly or tongue in cheek, but there would be comments about, you gotta go get that VP job, you're gonna do this. And even a friend yesterday who's gonna join us for drinks tonight was saying, one more step, talk about this podcast, JB's world domination. I'm like, that's not who I am. But I think that the lens of people who had only been at larger organizations, they see that kind of scrappiness. And the only time that they maybe seen it in the large organizations were when somebody was completely vying for position and being political in their maneuvering.
When someone was Pac-Man.
Exactly. And I'm not interested in gobbling up more stuff for me. I mean, the reason I'm here is not because I like to talk about myself whatsoever. I'm an introvert. I like to stay quiet, stay humble. That's why I did a really bad job of networking in Indy while I was at Curva, was because I was just focused on the job, and I'm trying to make up ground for that now that I'm hiring locally. And I wish I had done a better job of that between now and then, but I don't like self-promotion whatsoever. The reason I'm here is because I want to give back to the community to whatever degree I can. And I think that this is an investment in the longer term work and play for the engineering organization at Combined Curiosity. So I always have a motive. It's never usually directly me. That's very secondary for me, to a fault many times.
What were you doing at Kairos? Like building a team, heading up a product line?
All of the above. So one of the technologies that I had become familiar with and fell in love with was Lucene-based search. And I just love the information retrieval space. It kind of even harkens back to that interpersonal communication degree. I love communication. I think that that is the last frontier of startups, is how do you solve people talking to one another, right? It's not the tech. One of the things I tell our engineers at CC is, we are sending Teslas to Mars, for God's sake. Nothing we're doing in our organization is that hard. But consistently hard thing across any organization is for me to take the electrical impulses that are happening in my skull, make a sound with the hole in my face, for you to magically know what I mean. And that communication problem is ever present, and it's always there at any level of any organization.
You had responded, I think, to a Stack Overflow ad.
I did, yeah. And so I was going to be joining the team. They were vetting me as a principal search engineer. I love search and information retrieval, but I didn't want to stay in an IC role. I knew that. And so during the interview process, I kept pushing on. Do you know when you'll open up a management position? I know you can't promise 6-12 months that I can have it, but do you think 6-12 months there will be one? And by the time I got on with one of your former guests, Nasheen, VP of Engineering at Kairos, whatever I said, thankfully, convinced her that maybe we should just go ahead and backfill the management role that the director I was going to report to, they had not yet reopened. He had been the manager, he got promoted to director, and they hadn't opened the management position yet. So I ended up getting the management role by the time they hired me and we signed the paperwork. And then day one was team building, because there was only one person there on the team. I hired a guy also named John, who had applied for that same role I applied for 6 months before and chose not to take it. And so because he passed on it, I got to apply and then get the management role and then give him the role that he originally applied for that I ended up not getting because of the management role opening up. So pretty crazy. And then continued to build the search team, rebuilt the product from the ground up with a new version and much better architecture and whatnot. And not to say that it was bad architecture when it was first made, but with where the company was whenever I joined, we were falling over weekly. And so by the time I left, we had basically done 10x in both directions, both cost savings, a tenth of the prior architectural costs, about 10x the throughput, both in terms of the indexing and the data operations, and then the actual servicing via the API. So just a huge success story, amazing engineers there. And went from building the search team and the new search platform to taking on a second team about 6 months in, called Guided Experience, which was all about helping users, quick zoom out, patient access is what Kairos did. So you need to find a doctor for your annual checkup, or you've been having some heart palpitations and we help you find that. But there's a lot of mismatch in terms of finding scheduling times and making sure that you have all of the business requirements that the hospital or the physician would want you to have before showing up. And if you don't match those and you don't find out until the day of, everybody's time was just wasted, right? And so guided experience was a means of helping to get ahead of that, to where as you're trying to take this 9 a.m. appointment, it makes sure that it's your left knee that's painful, not your right knee, because this doctor doesn't like right knees and won't ever talk about right knees, whatever the case is. So just kind of those business rules for the physician.
Or like an elderly person not going to a pediatrician or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Maybe they signed up for a generalist that they did not notice was a pediatrician. So putting in your age, or vice versa. Another doctor doesn't want to see children. So are you signing up for yourself or for your 15-year-old? That makes a difference. And so just help to cut out some of that noise in the booking process. And then another 6 or 8 months later, promoted to director and took the helm of the provider match application space, which was the search team, the GX team, but then also the enterprise and then the consumer side of provider match. And those were the front end teams that were out there actually in the market that were being serviced by these back end functions. And wish I had been able to stay longer and see more of their success. Amazing group of people. And we were on the road to some pretty awesome victories, but I was only in that role for probably 3 or 4 months before joining Combined Curiosity.
And so what is Combined Curiosity?
So we want to help people cut out the noise. There's a lot of negative flywheels out there right now, whether it be traditional media, social media, and our lizard brains are not good in a world where if it bleeds, it leads is the basic way of operating. And we're trying to do that at scale. So we want to help people self-actualize. We want to help people self-discover because they are investing in themselves via passion, hobby learnings. So picking up guitar, picking up sewing, picking up hydroponics, learning to paint, something that is pretty distinctly human. It has no purpose. It's not necessarily monetized. It is culture. And it is that next level of living. And, you know, you look at the stats with depression, with anxiety, especially within the modern world compared to other portions of the globe. And we are so plugged into so many things that we don't know how to actually thrive ourselves anymore. And so our big goal is to help people self-actualize and climb up Maslow's hierarchy, essentially. One of my go-to phrases is a glass can only spill what it contains. And we're filling ourselves up with so much polluted stuff. Within the industry, garbage in, garbage out, right, with machine learning. And we're the same. You put all this garbage in, you're going to get some sour stuff out. And so we're trying to find great creators who are teaching piano, who are teaching guitar, who are teaching painting, whatever the case is, and give them a platform by acquiring them. And then, like we were talking about earlier, taking the grind out of it so that they're not worrying about QuickBooks. They're not worrying about marketing. They're not worrying about any of those logistics, shipping of their paint kits or their piano books. They're worrying about creating the content that people are ingesting. They're worrying about helping students thrive as they go on this journey of learning a new skill. And we take all that off their plate. We help them get better market penetration. We have tech enablement, both for the marketing side and then also the learning experience itself, to where it's hopefully the best learning experience somebody could have. Because as we all know, especially in adulthood, learning a new skill is really tough. There's a lot of inertia to overcome. There's a lot of friction. And then there's a lot of noise out there. Because if you go to YouTube and try to learn piano, yeah, there's going to be some great content, but you got to swim through a lot of bad content. And what if that great content only has 4 videos and now you're ready to continue, but you don't know where else to go because it's not a thorough catalog or portfolio of things to learn? So we're trying to find the kind of the middle ground between a Udemy or a Gumroad where it's all about the creators and anybody can come create any level of content, and then Masterclass where it's the top 1% giving you 3 hours of cool insights, but you've never touched a piano before. So how's that going to help you? So we're trying to find that middle ground there.
Yeah, I've seen like sometimes you will find some cool stuff on YouTube and it is hard to self-curate and separate the signal from the noise. And sometimes someone will have a Patreon for YouTube or whatever, or their podcast will have a Patreon and you can pay and get more. But this sounds like a concentrated way to really get to the bottom of what you're trying to learn. What are some of the brands associated with this? I think you mentioned like Piano in a Flash or Astra Oil Painting became part of this.
Yeah. So Piano in a Flash is where it all started before the founders realized, hey, we can abstract and do this across a portfolio of brands. Piano in a Flash is with a guy named Scott, who's just a brilliant teacher and fantastic human being, who was on PBS for years, won multiple Emmys teaching piano, and then thought, hey, let me turn this into a tech thing where it can basically be my retirement. It did well and then kept doing better and better and then just shot to the moon during COVID. It had already had huge jumps the year before, but then 8x'd during 2020, half of that being the first 2.5 months of quarantine. But then last year, we didn't quite keep pace, but we were just under it. So instead of about 8.1, we were at 7.5 ARR, which is a huge success without the quarantine factor, right? So everything is still growing, and January was our best January ever. February was our best February ever. So everything's moving in the right direction. We also have a oil painting brand called Master Oil Painting. We're in talks right now with another painting company out in Colorado, and that should probably close in the next 3 to 6 weeks. Have another one that's a sewing company that's pretty far into the process. We're in the middle of due diligence. And the hope is that we get roughly 5 this year, all the while on my side of the organization, building out the infrastructure for us to actually house all that. Because up to this point, it's been all duct tape and bubblegum with third-party integrations, with WordPress sites, with 10, 12-year-old Rails app for the learning environment. And so just trying to get our ducks in a row to where we really have the trellis upon which the company can grow.
And so where do you want to get to with that, with the tech stack? Is it like JavaScript front end, all componentized, or?
So it was a JavaScript house before I joined. So we're staying with JavaScript. We are trying to make everything as componentized as possible. We're using a pretty nascent technology called Bit. I think they're transitioning this month actually to bit.cloud, and essentially just the reusability and versioning of components so that you have some hero organism that's built off of obviously the smaller atomic components of a banner, a call to action, and a little quip or title. And if we have 5 brands using that, and brand 6 has some sort of idiosyncratic thing, or because we want to experiment on the marketing side for better conversion rates, maybe we have version 1.2 of this component that we get to plug in there and see how it goes without totally foobarring the other 5 brands that are using it. So it helps to pull out some of the brittleness that a more traditional componentization workflow would have, like with Storybook or something, where whenever you want to make the update, now you got to make sure that you redeploy to all of the different apps that are using it. You have to make sure that there's no breakage whenever that happens, all these different things. It gives us a little bit more flexibility in terms of experimentation and really the historicity of what's changed and why, which we want for the sake of this long tail experimentation mindset of what has worked, where has it worked, try to figure out and hypothesize why has it worked so that we can then double dip across other brands and become more effective.
So is it all kind of about finding the best method to a greater conversion rate for people with these passion learning interests?
Yeah. So if we believe that people are better off investing in themselves, and if we believe we have good creators who can help them do that better than the YouTube or the Patreon or the typical ways that people try to find things, then it kind of sums out to, it's a moral impetus for us to make sure we get in front of as many eyeballs as possible with the greatest conversion rate we can possibly muster so that we can get them in and help them live those better, more fulfilled lives with a piano on as part of that or painting as part of that. And so, yeah, the end goal for that side of the equation is, how do we better convert? Once they're in, how do we best help them to learn? How do we ensure that this is sticky, that they have the feeling of being better, even if they're not necessarily getting better as fast as they want? There's kind of at least 2 paths there as you're learning something new. You can know that you're getting better and still not feel better about it, but you can feel better and be much slower in getting better. It was kind of like dieting. You could do a crash course Atkins diet and lose 10 pounds and be miserable, and you know you're going to fall off of it in 2 weeks. Or you could do the thing that's much slower, it's more plodding, but 6 months from now, you're still on it. And hey, is that 6-pack I'm starting to see? You know, like, so we want those long-term outcomes, which requires immediate-term stickiness for the sake of consistency. So yeah, those are kind of the 2 broadly speaking areas of interest, is the marketing side and then the learning side.
It's always difficult to sell that long effort version to the lizard brains.
It is. Yeah. Which is why, you know, back to the diet stuff, you got to have your cheat day. You got to have these little things, you know, with the learning experience. It'll be community or gamification or some way of feeling that win more immediately. Essentially helps to aid you in the marshmallow test. Instead of just saying, wait 10 minutes and you have them all, it's like, well, if you wait 1 minute, we'll give you 1. And then you wait another 5 minutes, we'll give you 2. And then eventually you get all 10. You know, ways of kind of slicing it out to where we can know what we're up against with the lizard brain and also leverage it to get people to the place that we want them to get to.
Now, besides playing some gigs with your acoustic guitar, is there anything else you do for fun around Indy?
Oh, man. I don't let the grass grow underneath my feet. I've got two kids. They are everything to me. And so we boulder. My son loves bouldering. He's 10. My daughter's 8. Bouldering is, you know, rock climbing without the harnessing and whatnot. So we love doing that. I play soccer. New league starts on Sunday. Actually, one of our recent analytics engineers, part of his offer was that he could be on my team because we started talking about soccer during his interview process. And I said, hey, if you join, I'll make sure that there's a spot on the team. So he signed and he's going to be playing with us on Sunday. I do yoga just so I can stay flexible and try to take care of my body. I motorcycle. I love reading. I love playing my music. I'm a curious person. I am infinitely curious. And so combined curiosity is certainly the place that I think fits me pretty well because I want to help other people explore these things. There's a lot of life. And unfortunately, I have no evidence of reincarnation. I hope it's true because I would love to do this thing again because there's so many things I wish I could do. And unfortunately, time is an ever-pressing constraint, but I'm going to soak it up all I can in every way that I can.
What position do you play and what position does your new employee play on the soccer team?
Found out just the other day, the same, we're left back. I'm by no means a great soccer player. I've picked it up the last couple of years and started to really enjoy it. I would like to do a little bit more striker playing just to see if I can do it. Whenever I've done pickup games the last couple months during the off season, I've scored some goals and that's really fun. And I would love to try that a little bit more, but we'll see. So Safe plays left back as well. So that may help be a forcing function to get me into some other positions and try them on for size.
Are you watching Premier League games and taking notes?
I watch them on Instagram. I was talking with Safe just the other day about I need to figure out the best subscription service to watch games because I really want to now.
Unfortunately, it is Peacock, which is a little pricey, but in general, they have a bunch of the Premier League games. If you want English soccer, I think Fubo, yeah, they will also have Bundesliga and some of the Italian and Spanish games and Portuguese games.
Gotcha.
Then some of the Premier League actually makes it onto USA and some of the other channels here.
Nice.
So you can just TiVo it if you are so equipped.
Very cool. Yeah, I appreciate that. I'll have to check it out for sure.
So I assume Combined Curiosity is growing rapidly and hiring?
Yeah, we're definitely in a high growth phase. Beginning of last year, we were at 3. Now we're roughly 24-ish or so. I had 3 engineers of different sorts start last Monday and another one start yesterday. And so I'm definitely looking to hire more talents for those who want to help us get people to climb that hierarchy of Maslow's and self-actualize and make a dent in the learning space. Would love to have you join us. Check us out at combinedcuriosity.com. And even if you're not so sure that you want to check it out anyway, and let's see what we can do. And one last appeal to all my engineering friends out there. One of our values is that we like to think in bets, and check out Annie Duke's work on that. If you haven't heard of it, it's great. So my CEO and I have differing intuitions in terms of a podcast being helpful for the hiring effort. So the bet is that I think this will be helpful for our brand out there and for connecting with amazing people and getting some good partnerships and maybe even some hires out of it. So if you wouldn't mind helping a fellow engineer prove a CEO wrong, I think we can all enjoy that together. So help me out, hit me up, and yeah, can't wait to talk to you.
All right. Well, we will have John's contact information, his LinkedIn and so on in the show notes for this episode. And you can also check them out at combinedcuriosity.com. So, John, thank you very much for joining us and sharing with the listeners of Underserved your experiences.
I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.